Charles Lichter is going to talk about superconductivity.
Now, I need a... Well, I felt very honored to be invited to give a talk on this occasion, a celebration of this wonderful 50th anniversary of Physical Review Letters. The first editor of this, of course, was Sam Goudsmit, whose picture we saw earlier. I had the wonderful experience of having him as a teacher. In the summer of 1946, I'd come back from the war and I was taking, and I took a mechanics course that Sam Goudsmit taught. And he was a marvelous, colorful person, and this personality came out in that talk. Of course, he's probably, all sorts of people think he won a Nobel Prize because electron spin is such a famous thing, but of course he didn't. In any event, in connection with this celebration, it was suggested to me that there's another celebration that is very close in time. Namely, last year was the 50th anniversary of the Bardeen-Cooper-Schrieffer theory, and it was suggested that I give a talk about the experiment that my student Chuck Hebel and I did in connection with this theory. And so today what I will do is to tell you why we did this experiment. I'll tell you how we did the experiment, and then I will tell you what we learned from it. So in 1949, I came out to the University of Illinois. I got my PhD and came out there as an instructor. And fairly early on, I had a group of wonderful graduate students, Dick Norberg, Don Holcomb, Tom Carver, and Bob Schumacher. And we'd been looking at things. We did experiments to investigate Overhauser's ideas about dynamic spin polarization. And we did these measurements to measure for the first time the spin contribution to the magnetic susceptibility of metals. And then, in addition to that, Norberg and Holcomb and I had been doing experiments on the spin lattice relaxation time of conduction electrons in the alkali metals. Now, if you take a sample of nuclei which is unmagnetized, that is, unmagnetized as far as nuclei are concerned, and you put it in a magnet, why, you will split the energy levels with the Zeeman splitting, a spin up and spin down energies being different. And when the system is first put into the magnet like that, you have equal numbers of both the up and down spins. But over time, you will come to a thermal equilibrium magnetization of equilibrium with a lattice in which contains the nuclei. And for that to happen, some of these nuclei here will have to drop down into the lower state. And in that process, they have up to give up energy to the surrounding lattice. And that process is called the spin lattice relaxation process. And the length of time it takes to go from this condition to that is characterized by this time, the spin lattice relaxation time. And so that's what we measured in these experiments. Now, I need to give you a little bit of a historical background. 1950 was really a big year. That was the year for superconductivity. That's the year where the discovery was made that the transition temperature depended upon the isotopic mass of the material itself. And that's also the year where the Ginzburg and Landau theory of superconductivity was proposed. Of course, it was many years before the Nobel Prize was awarded that to Ginzburg in 2003. It was likewise the year in which Brian Pipard showed that the superconducting wave function has a coherence length, a distance over which the superconducting properties are somehow linked in an important manner. And as a result of that, why, he showed that probably the London equations, which were up to that time the theoretical model for describing superconductors, were probably non-local equations. And then evidence began to develop for what's called a gap in the density of states. Now here is a picture. Let me see this thing. Oh, here we go. Here's a picture of the density of states of electrons versus energy. Consider that the zero of energy is way off to the left. And in normal metal, this is just sort of a smooth function that rises and goes through the Fermi energy. And this concept was that that in fact, near the Fermi energy, there were some states that were not present. Now, the basis for this this thinking was the were experiments such as these experiments on heat capacity here. These were done at Westinghouse in 1954. One of the popular theories for phenomenological theories for describing superconductivity at that time was a two-fluid picture, in which people said, well, when you go into the superconducting state, some of the electrons become superconducting electrons, others are normal, and as you gradually cool from the transition temperature down to absolute zero, the fraction of superconducting electrons increases from zero at the transition temperature to 100% at the bottom. And going with that, people predicted a power law, T cubed, for the temperature dependence of this heat capacity. But as you can see on a number of different samples here, this is on a semi-log plot is much better fit by a straight line, and that deviates from this. Well, Bardeen, thinking about this, came up with a very simple picture in which he could actually do some calculations. He said, supposing what we do is simply treat the electrons as though they are the normal electrons of a metal, except we just put an energy gap in. And he found that if he did that, he could probably get the Meissner equations. And in fact, the form of the Meissner equations, which he said he thought that would resolve from this, from these calculations, was a non-local version, and so it was very much like the Pippard description. Now, he published that paper, and he was talking about it. And in fact, he gave a talk at Illinois, which I attended. He was trying to explain the origin of this energy gap. And the way in which he was trying to explain it had to do, of course, with the electrons interacting with the lattice, because the isotope effect had shown that the lattice vibrations obviously played a role. So this was his thinking. Now, he gave this talk, and in this talk he gave this theory, and he talked about an energy gap. Well, I have to confess, I really didn't understand it at all what the theory was. But I was really struck by the idea of the energy gap because of the experiments that Dick Norberg and Don Holcomb had been doing, realized that the nuclear relaxation time in a metal arises from the interaction of the nucleus with the electrons, and it's just the electrons at the Fermi surface which are the key electrons. And therefore, if this idea was correct, there had to be an enormous effect on the nuclear spin lattice relaxation time. So I'm sitting there, God, I'm really excited, you know. This is a wonderful experiment, and so we have to do this. And then, of course, it didn't take me long, I'm still sitting there, to realize that the problem was that this is a superconductor, and superconductors don't let magnetic fields in them. Now, you know, in those days we were doing NMR and the magnets, which are about 1 Tesla, 10 kilogauss, and the NMR frequency are around 10 megahertz. You understand, many of you aren't aware of the fact that for a long time we didn't know about type 2 superconductors. This is before the discovery of type 2 superconductors. The type 1 superconductors are all we knew about, and we didn't think of them as a type. That was superconductivity, and it excludes the magnetic field. So this is the problem. How do you measure the nuclear relaxation time by magnetic resonance in a material which won't let you put the magnetic field in it? Well, an idea occurred to me, and actually before the talk was over, I quit listening to the talk. And I'll explain that here. It's the idea of self-field cycling. And so I just remind you of what the phase diagram looks like for the type 1 superconductor. If you apply a magnetic field to the superconductor, and the magnetic field is very strong, why you suppress the superconductivity. But if the magnetic field you're applying is not too strong, it can be a superconductor. And so you have this sort of a curve as a function of temperature in which you have superconducting region. And so the idea of the experiment was basically the following. Here's this material. Let's say this is the strength of magnetic field that separates the normal state from the superconducting state. So we apply magnetic field, which is way above that value, so the sample's in the normal state. And now, in the normal state, why, if you wait a little while, you'll establish the nuclear polarization. Then you, after that's happened, you turn the field off. And in that process, you're going to turn it off in a time fast compared to any of these energy exchanges with the lattice. So the nuclear spins are thermodynamically isolated from the lattice on the time scale I'm talking about. And that means this is an adiabatic demagnetization process. And adiabatic demagnetization is the way you cool things. So the spins, by the time you get down to here, the nuclear spins, are at a very cold temperature. They're much colder than the lattice. Now the lattice, of course, is already cold because I'm down at a temperature where this can be a superconductor. But the nuclei are much colder than that. If you sit down here, why, the nuclei, and you have spin lattice relaxation, the nuclei are going to warm. And so you let the thing sit here for a while and they warm. And then we want to see what's happened. So we turn the magnetic field back on again. And as when we turn the field back on again, this is an adiabatic remagnetization. You come up to this value here. And we have our NMR frequency set so that this value of magnetic field is where we will satisfy the NMR conditions for our apparatus, and so we'll get a little signal at this point, and we can look at its size. And we can see from that size how much magnetization changed during this period down here. So you study the strength of this signal as a function of how long you have been sitting down at that temperature. Now, there are a lot of different materials that are superconductors, and the question is, which one of them do you want to study? Well, there are two problems. One is you've got to get the sample to be a superconductor, so you have to be able to cool it. And the other thing is, however, the turn off and the turn on has got to be fast compared to the spin lattice relaxation time. Otherwise, when you inspect, what you'll inspect is what happened after you left the superconducting state. So this is our problem. These guys here are wonderful nuclei from the point of view systems from the point of view of the transition temperatures, but the spin lattice relaxation time was going to be so fast. We thought that was really hard. Aluminum, on the other hand, is about a half second. Now. At that time, there was a very bright student who was out working at the Betatron, and he'd gone to DePauw University over in Greencastle, Indiana, and two of my students, Don Holcomb and Dick Norberg, also had gone there, and they had persuaded him that they talked to him and said, you know, you ought to come over and do magnetic resonance. Don't work at the Betatron. So he came over, and I proposed this idea to him, and he was quite excited. And so this is what he took on. Here's this picture of him in 1952. That's from his application for admission to the graduate school at the University of Illinois. So there are really two problems that we had. One is the cooling. The transition temperature for aluminum is 1.17 degrees. So we could either cool by adiabatic demagnetization. Now, this is not the nuclear one, but I mean, you know, have a big magnet and a salt pill and so on. Or we could do it by pumping on helium. This is the first experiment my group had ever done at liquid helium temperature. And I thought that the business of trying to do adiabatic demagnetization, you know, in addition to having and turning off another magnet for the field cycling, would be just much too difficult. So we decided what we would do would be to go with the pumping. And fortunately, those of you who've ever tried to cool helium by pumping, normal helium-4 by pumping, know it's very hard to get down to 1.2 degrees. And so it's exceedingly hard to get to 1.17, let alone get below that. But we got help from John Wheatley and Dylan Maypother, who were low-temperature physicists, and Chuck built a designed and the glass blowers made a double helium doer with a nitrogen thing outside of it, and we actually were able to pump down to 0.94 degrees Kelvin. If any of you ever tried to cool using helium-4, I think you will recognize that was a real triumph, and we were very proud of that we could get there. Whoops, wait a minute. The other thing, of course, is we had to be able to turn the field off and on fast compared to the relaxation time. Well, you know, the typical magnets people were working in, they're working up at fields of 10 kilogauss. And those magnets, big iron magnets, you know, would take a minute or so to turn off under the best circumstances. So we had to make a magnet. Now, since Chuck had been out at the Betatron, and Betatron was made out of laminated iron, the Betatron magnet, and we knew there was some, he told me there's some leftover iron sheets out there, and so indeed that's what we got. So we made a magnet. Here, you can see it here, this thing. Here's the magnet, here are its coils. Here's our doer system hanging down. And with this magnet, we were actually able to turn the field off in about a millisecond. But we started with the system magnetized in only 500 gauss. You know, to make a magnet you turn off quickly, you lose a lot of field strength. So instead of 10 kilogauss, we were down at 500. So this is a lot weaker signal than you get normally. So we turn off, and we were running an NMR at 400 kilohertz instead of 10 megahertz. And so you would come down, sit, and then come up. And if you want to know about that, you can read the papers. I'll have to tell you about that. Now, in the in a normal metal, the theory of a nuclear spin lattice relaxation had actually been worked out by Coringa. And the way to think about it is to say this is really a scattering process in which an electron interacts with a nucleus through the hyperfine interaction, and an electron comes by and interacts with the nucleus, and the spins flip like that. And so there's a scattering formula which gives this. So what do you expect? Well, the two fluid models would make you realize it should be slower. And likewise, if you have an energy gap present, why you think it would be slower. So we certainly expected that the relaxation was going to be slower. But here's what we found. Now, these curves are curves which I want you to forget about for a moment, and I come back to them. These are calculated with the BCS theory. This is 1956, before the BCS theory. And so these are our data. But you see what happens. The spin lattice relaxation time is twice as fast down at this temperature as it would be in a normal metal. So instead of being slower, it was faster. So that was an enormous puzzle. Well, I went to talk to Bardeen about this, and we had some ideas, and And they said, well, those, maybe they're right. But, you know, there was no theory, so all we could do was wave our hands. About that time, Mike Tinkham did this famous experiment with Roy Glover, in which they actually measured the existence of the energy gap. And as I say, this was 1956. There was important theoretical developments meanwhile had been taking place. David Pines had been in Illinois as a postdoc with John Bardeen in the early part of the 50s. And he and John together worked out the way in which the interaction of the electron with the lattice vibrations would affect the electron-electron coupling. And Leon Cooper made this a famous discovery that if you have Phil Fermi C and a pair of electrons above it with an attractive interaction, that can lead to a pairing and a bound state. And then in October 56 came the announcement of John Bardeen's Nobel Prize for the invention of the transistor. And, whoops, sorry, left too fast. So here's John in his office at that time. So John went over to receive the Nobel Prize in December of that year, and he came back, and you can imagine the excitement there was in the department. I mean, to have a Nobel Prize winner in our department. And he's such a sweet man, you know, and he brought in the gold medal, which he showed all of us so we could see it. Well, then one day, in late January of 57, I was walking down the hallway in the physics building, and John was coming the other way, and he stopped me, and it was clear that he had something he wanted to say. And so I waited for him to talk. John was not a big talker, and those of you who knew him will know this. And you know, I waited, I realized if I started talking that I might stop him. He clearly had something to say. And so finally he said, well, Charlie, I think we've solved superconductivity. And so this was a fantastic experience. And of course, he and Bob Schrieffer and Leon Cooper had found this wave function and Hamiltonian that described the situation. Absolute zero. I believe that at the time they published their letter, they had not worked out all the stuff above absolute zero. And but they rapidly did that. And Chuck and I really wanted to see if the BCS theory would explain our data. And what was really wonderful of them was here they are trying to develop what happens at the higher temperatures and calculate all the properties of these things. They taught Chuck and me the BCS theory. They told us what the Hamiltonian was. They told us what the wave function was. They told us how you get the wave function for excited states. They told us what the density of states were. And so we just took that. And we went back and looked at the Coringa theory and converted it to using the BCS wave functions and things and did the calculation. And the curve that we got was this one here, which predicted there'd be a tenfold increase in the relaxation rate. This great increase is related to the fact that the BCS density of states is infinite at the edge of the gap, but it's an integral infinity. And so we realized that if you broaden the states, you would bring this down. So these are our theoretical curves that we worked out, assuming that the states were broadened. And so you could bring it down. But of course, we couldn't get down to these low temperatures. This is I don't have time to tell you about that point, but if someone wants to ask a question, that's something from some data of Fred Reif in Mercury. But meanwhile, in the 50s, Morrison Bone did wonderful experiments on ultrasonic absorption. And they showed that the ultrasonic absorption rate dropped precipitously when you go into the superconducting state. So very different from what happened with the nuclei, which went up. And You know, this is very surprising because sound absorption is likewise an electron scattering process. I mean, the conduction electron contribution to such a thing. Because a sound quanta is either absorbed or emitted, and that's a low frequency, and therefore it's a low frequency scattering event, so it should have the density of states squared multiplied by, the matrix element squared multiplied by the density of states, and then the Fermi function and 1 minus, and this is actually should be for two slightly different energies, but they're close to each other, so you just square it. And that's basically the same formula of the NMR relaxation. The only difference is the magnitude of what the matrix element is. And so they should have identical temperature dependence. But this was a very dramatically different, as you see. So what was marvelous was that the BCS theory really explains this. And the point is that because of these wave functions, which are pair wave functions, the matrix element that comes into this actually has two terms. And for NMR, these two terms are added, but for sound absorption, they are subtracted. And that makes an enormous difference. It removes this infinity effect for the ultrasound at the Fermi energy. And so that explains it, what's going on. Now I see I'm getting close to the end here, so I'm going to move fairly quickly. A dramatic event in 1958, the Atomic Energy Commission lowered the price of helium-3 by a factor of 10. And that made Seidel and Keesom realize that it was possible to use helium-3 as a cooling liquid, and you could pump on it. And of course, if you can pump on it now, the problem with helium-4 is that when you get in the superfluid state, you get the Rollin film. So that's what makes it hard to cool. This doesn't go superfluid until you get way low, and of course, that won a Nobel Prize when it was done by the Cornell group, and won another one when it was explained by Tony Leggett. Al Redfield had independently invented the idea of doing field cycling to measure the spin lattice relaxation in the superconductor. But he discovered that we were doing it on a visit to Champagne, and unfortunately we were way ahead of him in time, so he didn't start on it until later. And meanwhile, Chuck Hebel had gone to Bell Labs, and so so Al got helium-3 and cooled with it and was able to get low temperature points. Here's the figure from Leon's Nobel Prize lecture showing the NMR data and the BCS curve to fit it. Now, the important thing here then is that the BCS theory was able to give a complete explanation of why the relaxation time speeds up and jumps upwards there. But I think the most important thing is that it's the contrast between the temperature behavior of NMR relaxation and the temperature dependence of ultrasound, which is the triumph of the BCS theory. And the explanation for that difference is because of the pair nature of the wave functions. So these two experiments taken together give a clear demonstration that you have to have pairing, and that's the essential feature of the superconductor. Thank you.
Yeah, we have time for a couple of questions before the last talk. Any questions for Charlie?
How big a pump did you need in order to pump the helium?
Oh, I can't quote that sort of thing to you offhand, but we probably didn't even give that thing in our paper. But I can look it up if you'd like to know. No, the trick getting down there isn't having a big pump. You have to have a big pump, but the trick is to have very small holes into the inner helium container, so the Rollin film comes out slowly. No. No, I mean that would have had an enormously rapid spin lattice relaxation. Since the high Z elements have very fast spin lattice relaxation because their wave function, their hyperfine coupling is enormous. Hyperfine coupling goes up very rapidly with atomic number.
Okay, are there no more questions? Let's thank the speaker one more time.